The year was 458 BC, and a farmer was plowing in his field. It was outside the city limits of Rome, and across the Tiber River. And his name was Curly. And he was a rather elderly man at this point in his life. And as he plowed happily in his field, he thought so of, with satisfaction, oddly satisfaction, of his earlier days in his life. He had been a politician in Rome. He had been part of the Republic. He had been part of the mechanism that had started this Republic, this idea that men would be ruled by, basically, by the rule of law and by other men and that sort of thing, and not by just some sort of a tyrant. Well, over the course of that time, as he reflected and as he moved happily along behind his ox as he was plowing, he reflected on the various things that had happened and how he had been forced out. Those people that had been his friends had turned on him in many ways, their search for power in this new system, and they ultimately led to him having to retire to his farm and just be a regular farmer out in the field. But as he was reflecting on these things and reflecting of the times past, he looked up and he noticed that there were riders coming in the distance. There was a group of men coming, and he recognized them. They were some of his old friends. And as they approached, he called out. He said, "Is everything all right?" Oops. He said, "Is everything all right?" And they came up closer, and as they came closer, they replied that they hoped it might turn out well for both him and his country. And after sitting down with Curly in his house, they revealed to him that he had been elected dictator for a period of 6 months. Because the nation was in trouble, the Republic was in trouble. They were being attacked by two very powerful tribes. The Aquae and the Sabines were attacking. And the life of Rome itself was in danger. So these men had swallowed their pride and come to him, and because they knew that the people would follow Curly. And without much thought, he returned to Rome. He assembled an army, and in just a few days, really within a fortnight, he had subdued the enemies, the marauders, and not only subdued them, but he had gotten them to agree to a peace when he could have absolutely destroyed them. In a noble manner, he got them to submit to the Roman authorities. And then afterwards, there were some that said to him that he had done such a fine job. They said, "Rule over us. Take control." And it was expected that he would, because after all, he certainly could. He had been elected to be a dictator for 6 months. He'd been given that power. And so, not only that, but it was expected that, of course, he would take vengeance on his enemies, because now he could. He was in full position to do so. But to the surprise of many, when he was done, he relinquished his position. He sought no revenge on his enemies, and he sought no dynasty for him and for his children after him, his sons after him. He basically said, "I will not reign over you. This battle was not about me, and my remaining would not serve the greater good and the higher purpose for which I fought. I'm going home to my farm. And Curly did. He went home to his farm, and he lived out his days on his farm. Now, in these times, I think we probably are all drawn to all the politics and all that's going on in our world. And at times like this, this story comes back to me. In fact, I review this story from ancient Rome, regularly. And it constantly is popping into my head as I see the various machinations going on with our political leaders, where it seems that so many cases, the only thing that these so-called leaders have in mind is themselves, their cronies, their power, their control, each side pointing fingers at the other and seeking the upper hand. And I say, where is the justice? Where is the equity? Where is the sincere concern for the people? It seems to be just a game for them, to serve themselves and to keep control. And so often, there's this attitude of, well, this is good for me, but not for thee, it seems, with these politicians. Sometimes it seems that most of our so-called leaders on every side, and I'm not talking about right or left or anything, I'm just talking about those people that want this position of leadership. It seems that they're trying to show us how not to do the job rather than how to do the job. And as I think about this, I have a thing of some of the past, and maybe some of the old-timers will know what some of these things are. Does anybody know what these things are? Anybody ever seen these things? This only old-timers would know. They're called wacky plaques. Anybody ever hear of a wacky plaque? Well, I know this. My brother collected them, my eldest brother. And they're just funny cards. They're funny plaques. They have various funny things on them. They actually came out in 1959 in packages of chewing gum. And they actually sell online for a whole bunch of money nowadays. They're collector's items. It's got all kinds of funny things. Work fascinates me. I can sit and watch it for hours. Okay. This is a nonprofit organization. We didn't plan it that way. Okay, all sorts of funny things like that in it. But one of them that comes to mind when I look at our politicians, and I blew this one up. I scanned it and I blew it up. And it says, this is how I'm thinking of these politicians these days. I think they should all have this on their wall. It says, cheer up. You're not completely worthless. You can always serve as a bad example. So, what I'd like to talk about today is not bad examples, but the one I just talked about, good examples. And what is the missing element in today's leadership style? I'd like to briefly examine the right way to lead through the example of three politicians who didn't see themselves as rulers, but as servants to a higher cause and to their people. And so the title of my message is A Tale of Three Farmers. A Tale of Three Farmers. So we heard the first farmer, Curly of ancient Rome. The second one I'd like to go to as an example in the same category, and really he's the biblical example of Curly from Rome, going back several hundred years earlier, and that is the story of Gideon. So let's go to Judges, and I'm going to just for a little bit be in Judges chapters 6, 7, and 8. Chapters 6, 7, and 8 of Judges. And I think most people here are familiar. If any of us have read the Bible at all for any number of years, probably we could say the big thing about Gideon, what the big thing was and how he overcame with a very small group. I actually don't want to go through that story specifically, because that's not my point. What I find interesting about the story of Gideon is that there's a great deal about his motives and his character in this story. Many stories, in the biblical narrative, particularly in Judges and the books of Samuel and Kings and Chronicles. It describes the deeds very often, but doesn't say too much about the actual character. I want to focus on the character and the attitude of Gideon, because that is the purpose of what I'd like to examine today. The missing element in today's leadership style. And so, just to review, at the beginning of chapter 6 of Judges, it states the problem. Verse 2, it says, "And the hand of Midian prevailed against Israel, and because of the Midianites, the children of Israel made them the dens which are in the mountains and caves and strongholds." So basically, they had to go into hiding. And it says that the Midianites were coming, and the Midianites and their related tribes that came with them, multiple thousands, well over 100,000, came along. And they wanted to just destroy Israel. That is what it says here. And so, a leader needed to be picked. Now, in this case, it wasn't a group of Roman senators who went out. But in verse 11, it says, "And there came an angel of the Lord and sat under an oak," which was an Oprah, and so forth, pertaining to Joash, Abiezrite, "and his son Gideon, and he who threshed wheat by the winepress to hide it from the Midianites." Again, he was just trying to stay out of sight. He was threshing wheat in a concealed location, which is what a winepress would have been. "And the angel of the Lord appeared to him and told him that he had been chosen," in verse 12, "and called him a mighty man of valor." So, was Gideon puffed up about this and think, "Yes, of course, I'm a mighty man of valor"? No, it says, "The angel of the Lord appeared," and then in verse 13, Gideon said, "Oh, my Lord," okay, "if the Eternal be with us, why then is all of this befallen us? And where are all the miracles which our father told us of, saying, 'Did not the Eternal bring us up from Egypt?' But now he has forsaken us and delivered us into the hand of the Midianites." And this angel, this messenger from God, told him that no, he is in fact going to do this, and with a great and mighty deliverance. And again, I'm not going to cover the whole story. That would take, to do it justice, we would need at least another 3 hours. That's not the point, the story. But take a look at, let's go to verse 25. In verse 25, as part of this, so we're seeing Gideon is a man who is, he is not one that just jumped up and said, "Okay, am I going to save Israel? Actually, I changed my mind." Let's go back, because go back to verse 15. There's something about his character that I want to bring out here. "And he said to this messenger from the Lord, he said unto him, 'O my Lord, wherewith shall I save Israel? Behold, my family is poor in Manasseh, and I am the least in my father's house.'" So again, he wasn't saying, "Oh yeah, well of course God chose me because I'm strong. I'm from a noble tribe and a noble family." He said, "No, I'm from a tribe that at that time wasn't considered to be one of the great tribes in Israel." And he said, "And I'm the smallest. Ours is like the lowest class tribe in the whole in this already low income zone, I guess we could say." And so he said, "Why me?" But he took the job. And just to show that humility is not necessarily weakness, take a look at verse 25 now. Here, he was told in verse 25 that he is supposed to destroy the idols in his father's house, because his father had these idols. If he was going to go forth and in the name of the Lord he was going to do all of this, he's supposed to destroy the idols. So it says that he was instructed in verses 25 and 26 to go and to sacrifice a bullock and to tear down the grove at the end of verse 26 to use as wood for this sacrifice. And it said in verse 27, "Then Gideon took 10 men of the servants and did as the Lord had said unto him. And so it was, because he feared his father's household and the men of the city, that he could not do it at day, that he did it by night. And so he went and he did it. And he actually took the consequences. Again, he didn't even consider himself a brave man. He, all the way along, he was like, even asking for signs. Look, I'm not really a very strong guy. I'm from a weak tribe. I'm from a weak family. And I'm not really a very brave guy. Maybe I'm not the right guy for this job. But when God told him, yes, go ahead, do this, okay, it's going to be my victory, he didn't flinch, even when it was something that he didn't want to do. So he went ahead and did that. Let's move ahead in the story. So finally, he goes out, he gathers an army, he assembles an army and all that, and he has quite a few thousand men. And I think this is part of the story that most people know. Let's go to chapter 7 and verse 2. It says in verse 2 of chapter 7, "And the Lord said unto Gideon, the people that are with thee are too many for me to give the Midianites over into their hands, lest Israel vaunt themselves against me, saying, mine own hand hath saved me." So he said, look, this is not going to be anybody's battle. God said it's going to be my victory. And so he has them go through a process, which, again, probably most of us know. What he did was he had this process of testing them at the waters to see how they drank water out of the river. And he chose just 300 men because of the manner that they actually took the water up with their hands and lapped it like a dog rather than just jumping down, basically face down into the river. There's something about that that we could say, too, if we wanted to analyze the story. Why would he have chosen those kind of men? So he did that. He brought them to the water, and he got it down to nearly 300. And again, this is talking about over multiple thousands, 300 going against multiple thousands. And then, if we go down, verse 9 of chapter 7, he was told to go down. The Lord told him to go down, arise and get down, and go, and it's time to attack the Midianites in their camp. But God is understanding, and he knew that Gideon might have fear. So he told him that if he had fear in the next few verses, that he could go and actually go at night and listen to the conversations that were going on down at the camp. So he did. He sneaked down to the edge of the camp with his servant that night, and he listened, and it says in verse 13, it says, "And when Gideon was come, behold, there was a man that told a dream unto his fellow, and said, behold, I dreamed a dream, and lo, a cake of barley bread tumbled into the host of Midian, and came into a tent, and smote it, that it fell, and overturned it, that the tent lay along. And his fellow answered and said, this is nothing else save the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, a man of Israel. For into his hand hath God delivered Midian and all the host." And of course, the next verse, 15, says, "And it was so, when Gideon heard the telling of the dream and the interpretation thereof," that, notice this, that it doesn't just say he returned. It doesn't just say he got up and said, oh, good, well, this is a sign. Yeah, I'm going to go in and I'm going to get them. It says that he worshiped, and then he returned into the host of Israel and said to the men, arise, for the Lord hath delivered into your hand the host of Midian. And then it goes on, and it says, and he divided the 300 men into three companies and put a shofar in every man's hand, with an empty pitcher and a torch under the pitcher. And I think most of us know the story, that they were going to descend on it with that. But listen again. One of the fascinating things about this story is the detail where it shows about this man. Verse 17, "And he said unto them, look on me and do likewise." Now, I come from a military family. My father was in World War II. He was shot 5 times at Guadalcanal and taken off the battlefield as dead. So I have a special feeling for this sort of thing. what Gideon was saying here, unlike most commanders, particularly in ancient times, and even modern times, I suppose, was, okay, guys, go over there and give it to them. Let them have it. You can do this. I'll stand back here and give orders. No, what Gideon was saying here in verse 17 is he says, I'm going to be leading this. I'm going to be right there. Everybody's going to do what I'm doing. I'm going to be the first one in. He didn't ask them to put their lives on the line or anything else like that with this crazy idea of 300 going against maybe 150,000 men. Okay. And so he did. And he said, and then below the, he says, when I blow, in verse 18, when I blow with the shofar and all that are with me, then blow the shofars and on every side in the camp and say, the sword of the Lord and of Gideon. And of course they did this. And the rest of the story we know, they went in, they came in, they surrounded the camp at night, and they basically caused mayhem. They did this, they announced that they took and they each blew, and we know that a shofar makes quite a startling sound. And so all of them blowing, and then suddenly all this light appearing as the pitchers broke, and there were torches all around them, the camp. They began to slaughter each other because they probably assumed that everybody that was around them must have been the enemy. And so as a result, kind of a longer story short, they wound up slaying each other. And Gideon's men really had to do very little except go in pursuit after them. And it said just that the actual number of those that were slain within the next couple of days that this battle ensued, which they didn't have much necessarily to do with. It says that there fell, this is in verse 10 of Judges 8, I'm reading, that there fell 120,000 men that drew the sword from Midian and the related tribes. But there are other things in here. So I just want to get this one more thing in about Gideon. Because after this tremendous battle, remember, he had sent a bunch of people away, and they had wanted to be part of this. And suddenly there's this tremendous deliverance of Israel through Gideon. And let's look at the beginning of chapter 8, the very first verse. And it says, and the men of Ephraim said unto him, they asked him, why did he serve them in this way? And why did he not call them? They were going after the Midianites, they had this great victory. Why did he not take them along to share in this glory? Now, if I were in Gideon's place, I would have said, what are you talking about? Look what we did. Who are you to talk about? See what great things we did? And just 300 of us. I mean, I would have been all puffed up about it. That's how I would have reacted. But look what Gideon did. Again, look at his leadership style. And he said unto them, verse 2, what have I done now in comparison to you? Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the vintage of Abiezer? He said, just the grapes being brought in of Ephraim, of your tribe, is better than our finest wine. He's basically saying, look, I was nothing. I'm not the reason this happened. And it says, he said that God delivered the princes of Midian to them. And as a result, they were their disagreement and their anger towards Gideon subsided because they got a soft answer from him, and he humbled himself before them rather than vaunting himself. Okay, let's get out to the end of the story. So at the end, all of this is settled, and it's going to be taken care of. It's all settled, and the threat is gone, and Israel is safe. And so guess what the people want to do with Gideon? Let's go to Verse 22 of Judges 8. Then the men of Israel said unto Gideon, rule over us. They told him, rule over us. Set up a dynasty. They wanted his sons and his son's son to rule over them for the deliverance. But what did Gideon say? He said the same thing as that guy from Rome said. He said in verse 23, and actually if we continue down, he basically said, if we read, put it all together from verse 23 down to, oh, about verse 29, this is my condensation of it. He said, I will not reign over you. This is not why I took this job. My remaining would not serve the greater good and the higher purpose for which I fought. I'm going home to my farm. Basically the same thing. Humility is the key. Humility is the key. Not just humility. Humility coupled with action. Action through love and service to others. That's what it is. Oh, that we had that today, huh? Imagine turning on the news and seeing that happen with some of our political so-called leaders. This has been the attitude of great rulers through the ages. So we have two farmers down. So why did I decide to give this message today? This time of year, with the President's Day weekend, I think about George Washington. I think about our first president. Because he embodies the same sort of attitude that we're seeing here. He embodied that attitude. Earlier, I griped about how disappointing the performance is of all these other leaders. But at least at the beginning of our nation, we had a great example. We had another Curly. We had another Gideon. In fact, the founder of our nation was known as the model of all the best that a ruler should embody. George Washington was almost coerced into service as general of the Continental Army. After victory had been finalized in 1783, Washington resigned as commander-in-chief rather than seize power, proving his opposition to the dictatorship and his commitment to American republicanism. Afterward, he served as our first president and only reluctantly served a second term. And after that, he said, in so many words, I will not reign over you. This is not why I accepted temporary power, and my remaining would not serve the greater good and higher purpose for which I fought. I'm going home to my farm. And he did. But for Washington and for those who served under him, who was their model of an ideal ruler? Well, of course, Washington himself. But they actually equated Washington with that first story that I said. In fact, I have to admit something. What I did when I gave the name of that farmer, Curly, is I translated his name. His real name, okay, his name in his native Latin language would have been pronounced at the time Cincinnatus, which means curly. We pronounce it Cincinnatus today. And in 1783, the officer that had served under Washington formed a society in honor of their commander, and they called themselves the Society of the Cincinnati. That is, a society named after the Roman ruler Cincinnatus, Curly. A whole group of them. Washington's men viewed George Washington as the modern-day version of this temporary dictator of Rome who relinquished his power, because they felt that they were to live up to the same example that Washington and Cincinnatus had done. The Society of the Cincinnati is the nation's oldest patriotic organization. This is from the Society's website. I'm reading this, by the way. This is on theirs. The Society of Cincinnati is the nation's oldest patriotic organization, founded in 1783 by officers of the Continental Army and their French counterparts who served together in the American Revolution. In fact, the first major U.S. city settled after the Revolutionary War was Cincinnati. And it was named after this society, which was named after George Washington and after Cincinnatus. Cincinnati, the plural of Cincinnatus, in other words, a society where every member is a Cincinnatus, and embodies the principle that to rule is an act of service to the greater good, not for power, money, and influence, to serve the self. Maybe it is more than coincidence that our home office is in the city of Cincinnati. Who knows? It's also interesting, I find, for the United Church of God, that the city motto is Juncta Juvant, which in Latin means strength in unity. Humility is the key. Humility is the key, once again. Humility, but humility with action motivated by love in the service of others. That is the mark of great leadership. If we hear the message of the three farmers and learn that lesson, we are promised a reign as kings and priests at the return of our Lord and Savior. As it says in Philippians 2, and I'd like to conclude with this, Philippians 2, verse 3. Philippians 2 and verse 3. If people want to turn there or just listen, that's fine with me. Philippians 2 said, "Let nothing be done through strife or vainglory," that is through partisanship, "but in lowliness of mind, let each esteem other better than himself, than themselves. Look not every man on his own things, but every man also on the things of others." Through our words, deeds, and service, in humility and love, may we emulate the example of these three farmers.